Alrighty. We're in the book of Revelation. We are up to chapter 6. Yeah, I suppose I ought to turn to it as well. Not actually having it memorized. Okay. What's the book about? Trouble. Yep, that's right. Oh, you got trouble, my friend. Right here in River City. Got a lot of persecution of Christians. The book is about the persecution of Christians by the Roman Empire and the subsequent destruction of the Roman Empire as a judgment from God. a lot of silliness going on about Revelation, and you've probably heard a good deal of it. We don't have time to push through all that. The point is that the book is not the most difficult scripture in the New Testament. It is not even second most difficult. It comes in somewhere under Hebrews and Romans. But the book is a whole lot like a big political cartoon. You need to be able to see the symbolism involved and what the symbols mean. And don't get too excited by some of the peripheral details. We don't have to make every single detail mean some spiritual deep secret. We just need to get the overall sense of the vision that's taking place. Okay, last time we pointed out we're in the throne room of heaven. John has gone up into the throne room of heaven in the Spirit, and he sees one on the throne, and then there's a lamb that comes up on the throne as well. And the lamb is... Okay, Jesus, we got that one down. There's just no doubt about that. So where we're at now as we start chapter 6, we've got the Lamb on the throne. He has very forcefully taken hold of the scroll. At first, John was very sad because no one was worthy to open the scroll. It's written on both sides, sealed with seven seals, and no one's worthy to open it. But the Lamb very forcefully takes hold of the scroll, and he's about to open it. So we want to watch how these sequences work out. There are three sets. In the book, there are three sets of seven items that we'll see. There are seven seals, there are seven trumpets, and there are seven bowls. If you watch this sequence work out, you see that they all come together in the same order. Out of the seven, there are four that are very, very similar. There are four of one kind. Then there's a fifth one and a sixth one that takes place. Then there's some kind of an interlude that takes place. And after that comes the seventh one, which is absolutely unique. There isn't anything like that that's gone on before. So, what you want to watch for is this four of one kind, two of another kind, an interlude, and then there's the seventh one. We're actually not going to get to the seventh seal today because that doesn't come up until chapter 8. But we're going to do the six seals on the scroll. This is tragicomic, actually. People don't understand sometimes. You start talking about things like this, they don't understand what we mean when we talk about seals. In fact, when the Waco thing was going, y'all remember the Waco thing 15 years or so ago? And David Koresh is in the compound there, and the FBI and everybody surrounded the compound, and David Koresh sent a message out, and he said, "I will come out when I finish translating the seven seals." He's working out of Revelation. And let's face it, he was a kook. "When I finish translating the seven seals, I'll be out." So the FBI agent in charge immediately turned to his assistant and he said, "Get me all the information that you can on seals. And while you're at it, get me anything on otters, whales." He's perfectly serious. He's perfect. And any other pinniped, he is perfectly serious. He has no idea what's going on here, okay? So, let me explain a little bit about seals. See, it's funny, but it's not funny because they didn't wait and went ahead and started the big deal. Okay, the way a scroll works is like this. You roll the paper up. Like that. Well, if you let it go, it's going to open itself up again. So what you have to do is somehow stick it down. And they didn't have Elmer's back then, Elmer's glue. So how do you stick it down? Well, you could tie something around it, and that was fairly common. You could just tie a little ribbon or a piece of leather or something around it, hold it in place. But that means that anybody can read it, you know, because you can just kind of slip that out and read it, and then, you know, put it back in, everything's fine. That's called an open letter, and that was fairly common. But if you wanted it private, what you do is you roll it up real tight, and then you take wax, and you drop some hot wax, some melted wax on there, and then you put some kind of sign in it. A lot of people had a ring that would have an engraved face on it, and they'd stick that on there, and actually, they took it off their finger first, and then second. And then that would show that it was sealed. And then the only person who can break the seal is the person to whom it is addressed. Now, if somebody else breaks the seal, they can't stick it back together again and make it look right. So that's what the purpose of the seals. It's just privacy. In this case, there are seven seals on that. Wow! That means you're not going to get in, okay? This is not for everybody to know. This is just for one addressee to open. Only one is going to be worthy to open this, and that's the Lamb. So the Lamb is about to open the seals. Now, to open the seals is just what you can imagine. You just break the wax. And when that happens, some amazing things happen. Let's go to chapter 6, Revelation chapter 6. I watched as the Lamb opened the first of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder. Wait a minute, what? Time out. Who are the four living creatures? Where'd we see them? They're around the throne, okay? What's weird about them? Got eyes all over the place, you know, okay. And they've got how many faces? Got four faces. One looks like a man, one looks like an ox, one looks like a lion, and one looks like an eagle. Okay, so there's four living creatures, they've got four faces, they're surrounding the throne, and immediately one of them pipes up and says, "Come." This is just this one word, this command. I looked in verse 2, I looked and before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest. Now, a couple of things we want to point out. This is plainly not a Roman soldier. Romans didn't do archery from horseback. The Parthians did archery from horseback, and the Parthians were the bitterest enemies of the Romans. They were absolutely unconquered. The Parthians were, oh boy. If you can imagine a mix between the southern Russians and Ukrainians and the Iranians, those would be the Parthians. That's kind of where they lived. And Rome never conquered them. Fought them a lot, never conquered them. One of the reasons they didn't conquer them was because they did archery from horseback, so they could go really fast and then fire from a distance and run like crazy. And the Romans never could get them to, you know, just grapple on a battlefield. So, okay, this first rider is kind of scary to Romans already because he looks like a Parthian of some sort. The second seal is open. Verse 3. When the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come." Then another horse came out, a fiery red one. Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other. To him was given a large sword. Okay, he's got power to make war on the earth and cause people to launch into war, and he's sent out. Verse 5, when the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand. Then I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a day's wages and three quarts of barley for a day's wages, and do not damage the oil and the wine." This is extremely puzzling, especially to our way of thinking. But basically what's going on here is famine. The natural result of war is famine. Rations are always in short supply. Wheat, at this price, wheat would be about 12 times normal cost. Barley would be about 8 times, I think, normal cost. It's hard to do the exact equivalence, but at any rate, things are very bad. And I just want to remind you of something that I mentioned years ago in a different context entirely, but I know that you guys remember everything that I've ever said, so that's why I never tell the same story twice. In the Roman world, people ate wheat. People did not eat barley. If Romans had to eat barley, the Roman soldiers considered it punishment. If they were being punished, if they were forced to eat barley, it was just the wrong thing for them. So the fact that barley is so tremendously expensive would indicate things are really, really bad. Things are bad. And yet, oil and wine seem to be in abundance. Don't harm the oil and wine. These are kind of luxuries. They can't get a hold of the wheat and barley, but they've got oil and wine. How can that be? Well, the area of Italy, especially at this time in history, the area of Italy has always been very fertile for vineyards and for olive trees. They have a lot of olive groves there. So wine and oil would be fairly easy to come by. They don't grow grain there. They've never really grown grain in Italy. There are a few places where they can do pretty well with it. But the vast majority of grain that came to Italy during the Roman Empire came from Egypt. They imported incredible numbers of shiploads of wheat out of Egypt, which is one of the reasons why Egypt has always been critical to the Roman Empire. The whole Mark Antony thing, you've probably heard about that. They even made a movie. It was about securing Egypt for the Romans so that they'd have enough grain. Plainly, what's going on here is a famine. You've got this third horse comes out talking about famine issues. Verse 7, when the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death, and Hades was following close behind him. They were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. Does anybody have a translation that says something other than pale? No? Okay. This is one of those words that's really, really hard to translate, because what it really signifies is a pale kind of sickly green color. I don't want to get into too much detail. Pale, sickly green. The actual word is chloros, and it's from that word that we get the name chlorine for the gas, which is, guess what color? Green. So Clorox and anything like that comes out of this idea of chlorine, pale green. What color is Clorox, by the way? Clear? Kind of a sickly, greeny, yellowy, yeah, greasy kind of. Yeah, okay. So that was for free, cost you nothing. But that's the idea here. This is a pale green, sickly looking, just nauseating kind of looking horse, and the rider is Death. Okay, now it's starting to make sense. And Hades is right behind him. What's Hades? It's the realm of the dead. Remember that Hades is not hell. Hades is the realm of all the dead. Good, bad, indifferent, doesn't matter. All the dead go to Hades in this time. So you've got Death, and he's got power over a fourth of the earth. A lot of folks are going to die here, and by every means possible. War, famine, wild animals, disease, you know, whatever. They're going to die. So these seals are broken, and they have each revealed a horse and a rider. Remember, we've got four of the same kind. We've each got a horse and a rider, and they're sent out on particular activities. And their activities are like, the first one is about conquest, the second one is about war, the third one is about famine, and the fourth one is just about death, I mean, just in whatever form. Now, the thing for you to remember about this is they're sent out, but they don't get busy. Nothing has happened yet. They've gone out to take their stations, but they haven't done anything yet. It hasn't started. Okay. Any comments, questions, anything you want to bring up about that before we move on? Okay, we're going to get into a really key passage here with this fifth seal. It's important that you kind of capture the significance of this. Verse 9, when he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and the testimony they had maintained. They called out in a loud voice, "How long, sovereign Lord, holy and true, until you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood?" Then each of them was given a white robe, and they were told to wait a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and brothers who were to be killed as they had been was completed. Okay, fifth seal is broken, and John sees under the altar there in heaven the souls of people who died for the sake of Christ. The persecution is ongoing, and these people have died. And they plead for vengeance. How long are you going to put up with this? Go get them, you know, make them pay for this. And they're told to wait. It's not over. Just wait. So they're given a white robe, and they're told to wait, and there are more coming. Okay, now if you're a first century Christian and you've just been given this revelation from John, and you get to that part, how do you like that? Well, it's time to tug at your collar a little bit. It's not over? No, it's not over. Are you sure it's not over? I was really hoping for like some fast resolution. No, it's not over. There's more to come, and more people are going to die for the sake of Christ. Now, this is the first time we meet these souls. We're going to see them again later on, so don't just let them pass out of your memory here. But they're asking for vengeance, and they're just told to wait. Then the sixth seal is opened. I watched as he opened the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun turned black like sackcloth made of goat hair. The whole moon turned blood red. And the stars in the sky fell to the earth as late figs drop from a fig tree when shaken by a strong wind. You get some of this kind of vivid imagery there, you know. You don't want to try to make the fig tree mean something or the dropped figs or the wind. You don't want to do that. Just get the idea that these things just come tumbling down. The sky receded like a scroll rolling up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, every slave and every free man hid in caves and among the rocks of the mountains. They called to the mountains and to the rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand?" Okay, this sounds very startling language. The moon turned to blood, the sun is dark, and all that. That is very prophetic language. We've heard that stuff in the past, haven't we? Where did we read things like that? I've given you some passages to talk about in Isaiah and Ezekiel. Pardon?
Didn't Joseph have in one of Joseph's dreams?
In one of Joseph's dreams. Let's see. He dreamed about a family. Well, he dreamed about... I don't remember if the imagery of the sun turning dark or the moon turning to blood was involved in that. Yeah, sun and moon did bow to him in one of his dreams. That's right. Yeah. Of course not. Right. Yeah. That is. And we're talking about some very just kind of prophetic imagery here. And it comes up again. We see this same stuff in Isaiah and in Ezekiel when kingdoms are judged. When the Babylonian Empire is judged by God, this same kind of language comes up. The sun is darkened and the moon turns to blood and the stars fall. And then in Ezekiel, who is it in Ezekiel? Oh, Pharaoh, Egypt, is judged by God. There's punishment that's going to be inflicted, and the same kind of imagery comes up. Sun is darkened, moon turns to blood, all those things were supposed to fill people with fear and let them understand that, you know, bad things are happening on a kingdom. And so this whole kind of imagery comes up. Well, what's the response when these people see this, when the sky is darkened and the moon turns to blood? All the high and mighty and the low and miserable all together go running and trying to hide from the wrath of the Lamb. They're going to try to, you know, the wrath of the Lamb. Doesn't that sound a little paradoxical to you? Have you ever been attacked by a lamb? It seems a little silly, and yet the wrath of the Lamb is very, very real here. Okay, so God is just going to shatter this kingdom. The whole order of things, the whole system of the world is actually going to be shaken. So they ask, for the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand? And plainly, they don't think they qualify. The generals, the kings, the princes of the earth, the high and the mighty, they don't think they can stand. And they're right about that. Who can stand? Well, not them. Okay, comments, questions, anything on chapter 6? Yes, sir. Right. Don't damage the oil and the wine. How do I get what I said out of that? Oh, you have to be really creative, Norman. You know, just make this stuff up as you go along. Yeah, well, the point is that anytime war comes along and anytime war comes along, there will be shortages. Well, I guess I'm not following the question. Can you ask me one more time?
Well, I was reading what you had in this. It said it was...
Oh, you shouldn't read that. You shouldn't... What did I say? Yes. Yeah, the wine and oil probably would be abundant. The truth of the matter is, in the original, it's a little bit obscure exactly what the meaning is. Most translations come out with something like, don't harm it, don't damage it, but it's something about not messing it up. And so, the idea, you know, most commentators, they stop and they're just as puzzled as you are and as I am about it. And they're trying to figure out what is the point of this? Why is he saying this? And the best thing they can come up with, the best thing that makes sense, apparently, is that there's still going to be oil and wine available. The grain is going to be in very short supply, but there's still going to be oil and wine available. Don't mess that up. It's just a little difficult.
So you're saying they had instructions not to mess with the olive tree?
No, I'm saying that what the message is that the price of grain is going to be outrageous. And yet there seems to be plenty of oil and wine, that's going to be available. But you can't live on that. You know, I mean, it's nice, but those are luxuries, and yet, you know, the basics of life are not going to be available.
Although the olive trees and the grapevines would be harder to replace.
If they were destroyed, yes, they would be harder to replace. But we haven't got there yet. What we have is a threat. We have this huge threat hanging over the Roman Empire now, because these riders have gone out to take their positions, but nothing has happened yet. Anybody else? Anybody want to chime in? Give some wisdom on this. Am I missing something? Excuse me. Let's go on to chapter 7 then. And so, we watch the sequence taking place. We got four of one kind, and then we've got another seal, and then we've got yet another seal. And now we're going to kind of get into an interlude. And John is provided with another vision because we get this phrase, after this I saw. And when we see this, after this I saw, we've changed channels. You know, we're looking at a different vision now. Something else is taking place. So he's not seeing the seals being broken and the angels or the riders taking their positions and things like that. He's seeing something new. After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth to prevent any wind from blowing on the land or on the sea or on any tree. Again, that's one of those things kind of hard to figure out exactly what's going on there, but it seems like God is restraining any kind of impact here. Then I saw another angel coming up from the east having the seal of the living God. You remember what we said about seals? You got this ring or some kind of signet, some carved instrument that you press into the wax, and that signifies ownership. You know, you get that pressed in there, everybody can see, okay, that belongs to this guy over here. That's his signature, as it were. this angel has the seal that belongs to God. He called out in a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to harm the land and the sea, "Do not harm the land or the sea or the trees until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God." Then I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. From the tribe of Judah, 12,000 were sealed. From the tribe of Reuben, 12,000. From the tribe of Gad, 12,000. From the tribe of Asher, 12,000. From the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000. From the tribe of Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin, 12,000 each. And there's somebody missing. There's no Dan. No Ephraim, but you know what? You can include Ephraim in Joseph. But what you got is Joseph and Manasseh. That's odd. Don't get too excited about who's not there and who is there, because the important thing for you to remember is there's 12 tribes. Each of them get 12,000. That equals 144,000. That's a whole lot of folks. And the point of sealing them is identification and protection. So John hears the total, and it's 144,000. Now, you have to remember that numbers have huge significance in the book of Revelation. So you don't want to lock yourself up and say, wow, there's only 144,000, and that's all. And they have to be out of these particular tribes. Well, where does that leave me? Because I'm not in any of those tribes. Don't get too excited about that. What's going on here is, this is a picture that God is marking all of those who are His wherever they are. What, you know, by this time, folks, by the time this book is written, some of these tribes have absolutely disappeared. They have no idea where the descendants of these various tribes are. Remember, this is 750 years, 800 years before the northern kingdom had been destroyed and the 10 northern tribes scattered and dispersed into the world. Some of these tribes have just disappeared. They have no idea where they are. This is about the people of God. This is the true Israel. These are the followers of God, and they are identified as such. Do not harm the land or the sea or the trees till we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God. Now, obviously, not all the servants of God come from these literal tribes. That's just not possible, because by this time the Gentiles very plainly have been brought in. So this is a picture, again, of finding all of God's people and making sure that every single one of them is protected. Every one of them is identified by God. There is a religious group that makes a really, really big deal out of the 144,000, and it's just tragic because they've missed the point entirely. Or they missed the point to the whole book, but they certainly missed the point to this enumeration of God's people. Okay, verse 9. After this I looked. What did we do? We just changed the channels again. We've got a different vision that's coming up now. After this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and in front of the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands. And they cried out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." And the angels, or all the angels, were standing around the throne and around the elders and four living creatures. They fell down on their faces before the throne and worshipped God, saying, "Amen, praise and glory and wisdom and thanks and honor and power and strength be to our God forever and ever. Amen." Then one of the elders asked me, "These in white robes, who are they and where did they come from?" Did you notice their posture? The angels have fallen down before the throne to worship. What are these in white robes doing? Pardon? They're standing. That's the point. Who is able to stand? The enemies of God said, who is able to stand in the day of the wrath of the Lamb? Guess who? Those who went through the persecution. They're the ones who are able to stand. They're wearing their white robes here, and they're standing in front of the throne. The angels are bowing down and worshiping. Then one of the elders asked me, "These in white robes, who are they and where did they come from?" I answered, "Sir, you know." That's kind of an elliptical way of saying, beats me. You know, you're going to have to fill me in on this. And he said, these are they who have come out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will spread his tent over them. Never again will they hunger, never again will they thirst. The sun will not beat upon them nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will lead them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. So you've got all these people who have suffered the tribulation, they've gone through the persecution and maintained faithfulness, and they have achieved the reward that they wanted. They're in heaven. They're in the presence of God, and nothing bad can happen to them now. And it's a good thing, too, because there's a whole lot of bad things that are going to happen on the earth. None of those things are going to touch these people, but there are a whole lot of bad things yet to come. So, there's a series of judgments that is impending on the Roman Empire at this point. Okay, comments, questions?
One thing, Chris, I noticed is that sometimes we get thinking God's just up there and there's nothing going on, but this tells us there's more going on and we can't see.
Well, that's really true. We do kind of get the idea that God is just out there and he can't keep track of all the stuff that's going on around. So how involved and busy could he be? But it is important to recognize that God does know the things that are going on, and he is actively engaged in our lives and in our world.
The angels, which is supposed to be messengers, mm-hmm. for those that have salvation, well, all of them are working and going on that we can't see.
Yeah, and who could guess at what's going on behind the scenes? We have... Yeah, but it's good to be reminded that God really is in charge, and there are things much larger than what we can see. And, that's true of all of our lives, too. I mean, in just about every aspect of our lives, we have a really small perspective, and we look at just what's going on in our lives and what's going on in our neighborhood, and we don't really think about the larger picture, the bigger things that are going on out there. And sometimes it's good to be reminded, just get a little different perspective. The incense, bowls of incense, yeah, which are the prayers of the saints.
And that tells you there's a lot going on when we're praying.
Yep, there is a lot going on. Okay, anybody else? Yes, they are the ones who have suffered. The ones in white robes are the ones who have come through the persecution. They're the ones. Well, you ask a good question, and I can see where you're coming from, and there's good evidence to suggest that maybe that is the case, because we are told that we will judge angels, which would certainly put us in a superior position. We're going to judge the angels. Got to be somewhat above them in some form. And then one of the letters to one of the seven churches talks about those who are faithful will receive a white robe. So I do think that this is a symbol of victory. You know, bottom line, it's a symbol of victory. And we don't really know, I think, how the hierarchy in heaven is going to be, except we know who's on the throne and who's not. We're not on the throne. There's a good thing to remember. We're not on the throne. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
In Hebrews, this was written after Hebrews.
Yes. Right. No Jew, no Gentile. No. We're all one in Christ. Okay, this is just the total number of God's people. It's not specifically Jewish heritage there. All right, we're going to charge in, and I think we're going to have to go a little bit faster in some cases. We're not going to be able to look at every verse. So, bear with me next week. Lord willing, we'll charge ahead in Revelation.